From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
So you told the sheriff that you were walking to Nebraska.
That's right. To get my $1 million.
On today's Fresh Air, Alexander Payne tells us about making the film Nebraska, which has been nominated for 6 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actor. Also, actor Matthew McConaughey. He's been nominated for an Academy Award for his performance in Dallas Buyers Club. McConaughey first became famous for this line, which he can still recite.
That's what I like about those high school girls, man. I get older, but they stay the same age.
And film critic David Edelstein reviews The Wind Rises, the new film by acclaimed Japanese animator Hayao Miyazaki. The film's been nominated for Best Animated Feature. That's coming up on today's Fresh Air. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest is Alexander Payne, whose film Nebraska is nominated for 6 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Actor for the performance of Bruce Dern. Payne is nominated in the Best Director category. Nebraska is out on DVD next week. Payne's other films include Election, About Schmidt, Sideways, and The Descendants. He's directed Jack Nicholson and George Clooney in starring roles and has won 2 Oscars for Best Adapted Screenplay. Terry interviewed Alexander Payne last year when Nebraska was in theaters. In the film, Bruce Dern plays Woody, an old man who's beginning to show signs of dementia, which is maybe why he falls for one of those junk mail sweepstakes scams and actually believes he's won $1 million. He can't drive, so he decides to walk from his home in Billings, Montana, to an address in Lincoln, Nebraska, where he thinks he can collect his prize. Will Forte, a former cast member of Saturday Night Live, plays his son, who eventually decides to humor his father and drive him to Lincoln. They make various stops along the way, including his father's hometown. Here's a scene from early in the film, after a cop finds Woody walking on the highway starting his trek to Nebraska. Woody's son has come to pick him up at the police station and wants to know just what's going on.
So you told the sheriff that you were walking to Nebraska?
That's right. To get my $1 million.
What $1 million?
We are now authorized to pay $1 million to Woodrow T. Grant of Billings, Montana.
Let me see that.
And your mother won't take me.
Mega sweepstakes marketing. Dad, this is a total come-on. It's one of the oldest gimmicks in the book. I didn't even know they still did it anymore.
Well, I can't say it if it's not true.
They're just trying to sell you magazines.
It says I won.
So mail it in. I'll help you.
I'm not trusting the mail with $1 million.
That's a scene from Nebraska. Alexander Payne, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on the film.
Thanks very much.
So what interested you in the idea of somebody actually taking one of these sweepstakes come-ons at face value?
I thought it would be a nice premise for a little comedy. And I didn't come up with that premise. It came with the screenplay. It's the first one I've directed. It's the first film I've made with a screenplay. It didn't originate. I did a rewrite on it shortly before shooting. But it was the basic premise, the entryway into this whole story. I actually thought it was a bit specious to begin with because the writer thought of it 10 years ago when he originally wrote the script when Publishers Clearinghouse was still more ubiquitous, and now it isn't. Now it's largely Nigerians emailing us for the scams. So I had to put a line of dialogue in, which is, I didn't know they still did this anymore.
One of my favorite lines in the movie, on the way to Nebraska to redeem, you know, to quote, redeem the $1 million, they stop at Mount Rushmore. Because the son convinces his father, like, oh, let's just stop. It's on the way. And the father couldn't care less. And he's staring at it and thinking, like, oh, it's just a pile of rocks. It looks unfinished. Lincoln's ear isn't even finished. And then he says, okay, we've seen it.
Yeah, and before going there, he says, why do you want to see Mount Rushmore? It's just a bunch of rocks.
And that we've seen a thing, I thought, like, I know him.
Yeah.
I could easily imagine my father saying that about certain things.
Yes, yes. Well, I think that dialogue is both like your father. You can imagine him having that attitude about something ostensibly sacred. And then also the father who is, to my mind, staring death in the face and fixing to die. And for me, thematically, at a lower level, that's what the whole movie is about, is the father fixing to die and looking death in the face and the son offering to kind of help him do so, or certainly try to give him some shred of dignity before the old man croaks. Similarly, toward the end of the film, the son takes the father to see the old house, now completely dilapidated, where the father had grown up. And the son says, well, Dad, have you seen enough? And the father says, oh, I suppose it's just a bunch of sticks and some weeds.
And also the son says to him, let's see the house where you grew up. And he says, what for?
Nothing in this material plane has much interest for him anymore, is kind of what I'm getting out of it.
A lot of the people who you cast in Nebraska are from the area that you shot in.
Oh, yeah. I do that on every film, though. Mm-hmm. But the casting director and I really, really took it seriously on this one.
So were they people who were actors locally, like in regional theater or local theater? Or were they just people you liked their faces and you figured in the short scene that they were in, they could make it work even though they had no acting experience?
Yeah, it's both and it's a third. All my films, and this one even more so, are a combination of highly seasoned professional actors who typically live in Los Angeles or New York, local non-professional actors, as you say, community theater, local commercials, that sort of thing, local theater, and then non-actors, people really off the street or in this case off the farm. For this film, it took over a year of casting to find, for example, those retired farmers who play some of Bruce Dern's characters' brothers and their wives. It was a long process of putting out casting notices on, for example, rural radio after the farm report.
Really?
In small town newspapers.
How would they read? What would they say?
Oh, I can't remember. You know, motion picture casting out of Omaha, we are seeking, you know, and we'd have the descriptions of people we were seeking. And for example, for retired farmers, we weren't so much expecting them to submit auditions, so we were targeting their kids in their 40s, 50s, 60s, who might go over to their folks' house on a Sunday and say, hey, look at this, I read this, and come on, just for a hoot, let me put you on my iPhone reading these lines of dialogue and let me email it in to Omaha. And so slowly but surely over months, some of those began to trickle in. And that's how we began to assemble the cast. And so there are many people in the film who have never even been in a high school play. And my job with John Jackson, the casting director, is to try to ensure from before that they're all going to be part of the fabric of the same film. And then obviously directing on set, I have to make sure that the acting styles are sufficiently similar. I mean, at the same time that we're trying to find local non-actors who can reliably present an unself-conscious version of themselves when the camera's running, I also have to ensure that the professionals coming from the coasts are believable in that setting. So
that you can't tell the difference between the actors and the non-actors.
Correct. Yeah.
It probably helps that the lead actors were not like really big movie stars so that the non-actors weren't feeling like,
But I went through it even with Jack Nicholson. I had him, for example, in a scene in About Schmidt. He's ordering a dilly bar or something from a Dairy Queen in Omaha. And there he is acting in a 45-second scene up against the gal who actually worked at that Dairy Queen in Omaha. And I had to make sure that she was going to be bulletproof. That's the word I always use, bulletproof, when the camera's running. Sometimes it's not sometimes, all the time. It's a matter of making sure that the non-actors are going to be, as I say, bulletproof when surrounded by the lights and the technicians and the trucks and all the movie-making machinery. But also having the highly seasoned professionals act flatter than they might act in other films. Because real life is flatter than what we see in movies and theater. So, and that's the vibe I want in the films.
So I have to ask you, there's a scene when Bruce Dern and Will Forte are on the road together heading toward Nebraska, and they're passed on the highway by a bunch of bikers. Was that an homage to Bruce Dern's film, The Wild Angels?
No, I hadn't thought about that until you mentioned it right now. I was just thinking,
because he plays a biker in that.
Correct. Yeah. No, that was trying to make South Dakota seem real. Because when you drive through South Dakota, you always see a lot of bikers.
Fair enough.
And that was the single most expensive shot in the film.
Why?
It goes by quickly. Well, I thought, we're in South Dakota. We'll just get some bikers to drive by the car. And the studio said, no way, Jose.
Why?
That, insurance liability. You've got three moving parts. You've got the hero car, the car with the actors, a bunch of bikers. And we were in a moving vehicle behind shooting. And so they said, you have to fly in stuntmen from Los Angeles and rent the bikes and rent the costumes, and they will pretend to be bikers. And we did the numbers, and that was about a $50,000 hit on a very small budget, which I couldn't afford from the budget. So I actually had to make a special appeal to the studio. Will you give me $50,000 extra to get that one shot? And bless their hearts, they said yes.
I have a directing question for you, but in order to get to the question, we have to hear a clip. And the clip is an excerpt of an interview I did with Margot Martindale, the wonderful actress who a lot of people might know as Hilary Swank's mother in the Clint Eastwood movie. Why am I blanking out on the name? Million Dollar Baby. And also, she was terrific in Justified as this, like, Kentucky woman who runs this, like, kind of drug business. So anyway, so you were directing her. It's a film called Parish Atem. And this was like an anthology film. There's several sequences in it, several separate stories. Each story is directed and written by different people. So the one that you did stars Margot Martindale. And the story here is she's taking like an adult education course in French. And she decides to go to France alone. And it's not the like the exciting romantic trip to France that everybody hopes for, because she's still just alone and she doesn't really know French culture. She's not really sure how to get around. But at the end, she's sitting on a bench in a park watching the children play and watching other people, you know, lovers go by and everything. She has this just like little emotional moment of just seeing the beauty of life. And I was asking her about that scene, and I just want to play you what she had to say about playing that scene.
It was in a park in Paris in the 14th arrondissement, and I was sitting on a park bench, and this was like being me, this thing. I was sitting on a park bench, and I went from looking at some old people on a bench and thinking of my mother and all the people that were gone to panning over to seeing a playground full of children and thinking of my daughter growing up. And it just was there, just immediately.
Well, I can see how it would be there because the emotion is still so there.
It's just, you know, it's all about life. It was so easy. I'm sorry. It was so easy to do. Yeah. And so everything else was just, you know, and Alexander directed me as if he were directing a silent movie, which was fantastic. It was a perfect combination for me.
And that's the actress Margot Martindale talking about her final scene in the movie Parish Atem, and she was directed by my guest Alexander Payne. And she had talked earlier in the interview about her mother dying, which is one of the things she was thinking about in that scene. She obviously had this really like authentic moment of emotion while playing that scene, and even while just thinking about that scene, she was very emotional. I was thinking about you directing her and wondering, like, say something happened so that you couldn't use that take. Say, like, somebody walked by unintentionally or something happened and you couldn't use that perfect take. What would you do? Because you probably had a sense that she had went, like, so deep and was so fully experiencing the moment in character. It would have been hard, I think, for her to, maybe it wouldn't be hard for her to go there again. Can you talk about that?
You see in that clip that she has very ready access to emotion. And that's what the great actors have. And that's why life is often so difficult for them, because they can't keep their emotions tamped down
as
you and I can. So then if you can put an oil pump on that spurting oil well of emotion, then you can be a professional actor. I think we did 4 or 5 takes, and she was equally good in all of them. And it was just a matter of making sure the camera was right and the timing with the voiceover and so forth. But I clearly remember having 3 or 4 great takes to deal with. The good ones can keep it going. It's not just like, oh, one take where they really hit that emotion. Well, yeah, maybe. But let's try it again. The cameraman missed it. You know, the assistant cameraman made your eyes out of focus or something. We need to do it again. Or I remember telling Paul Giamatti in Sideways, he was really at a deep place. And I had to say, okay, stop, Paul. Could you please rotate your head 12 degrees to the left? I mean, we all have to understand that film is technical as well as emotional.
So if it is true, that observation that you just made, that actors more readily tap into their emotions and that those emotions are always kind of gushing and
Absolutely.
That's responsible for some of the problems they often have in life.
Oh, yeah. And I think, but, sorry.
Yeah, ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say there's a way in which I've observed that actors and directors envy each other. I think a director envies an actor's ready access to emotion and how beautiful that is. And I think actors can envy directors dealing more clinically with emotions, ordering them about dispassionately.
And a lot of actors want to become directors.
Good for them.
Alexander Payne speaking with Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's interview with director Alexander Payne.
I was rewatching The Descendants in preparation for our interview and arrived at the same conclusion I did the first time I saw it. It's really a terrific film. And it stars George Clooney, whose wife is in a coma after a boating accident. And that leads him to find out a lot about her and about himself and about his children. And it's like other films of yours. It both has a lot of emotion and humor in it as well, and you managed to find a really nice balance. But I love the opening narration, and I think the opening narration just tells you everything you kind of need to know to get in the right frame of mind for the movie. And I'd like to play that opening narration, and this is George Clooney. And as we're hearing this opening narration on screen, we're seeing shots of life in Hawaii. He's a Hawaiian who is descendant from a long line of important Hawaiians. So here's the opening voiceover from Alexander Payne's film, The Descendants.
My friends on the mainland think just because I live in Hawaii, I live in paradise. Like a permanent vacation. We're all just out here sipping Mai Tais, shaking our hips and catching waves. Are they insane? Do they think we're immune to life? How can they possibly think our families are less screwed up, our cancers less fatal, our heartaches less painful? Hell, I haven't been on a surfboard in 15 years. For the last 23 days, I've been living in a paradise of IVs and urine bags and tracheal tubes. Paradise? Paradise can go itself.
That's George Clooney's voiceover from the opening of The Descendants, directed by my guest, Alexander Payne. So you wrote that line, do they think we're immune to life?
Yeah.
I was wondering if you think some people have that thought about people in Hollywood, that they're immune to life because they make these like fabulous films and they live in a fabulous world and they have money and fabulous homes.
I don't know. I can't give a very good answer to that. I don't know.
What did you think when you were wanting to make movies and you were young?
I actually wasn't looking forward to it. But now that I do live part of the time in Los Angeles, I also live in Omaha, I like it. I've come to see it as a great, great city. And older Hollywood, because I'm a film buff, is fantastic. You know, you can trash living in Los Angeles or living in Hollywood, but I'm driving down the street and I turn and, oh, look, there's Vendome. There's the stairs that Laurel and Hardy carried the piano up in the music box. And here's the hero. I'm in Las Feliz. There's the house used in Double Indemnity. And it's just, it's delightful. And you think of what creation of culture for the world was created there in the teens and 20s and 30s and 40s. But I think about silent comedy a lot and what was done, the brilliance of what our comic actors did in the 20s. And I'm filled with pride.
What do you love about silent movies?
First of all, let me say I'm no expert. I like silent films a lot, but I know people who are experts and I'm no expert. But my line about it is that, for example, they say that often a filmmaker's first film can be his or her best. Why? Because he or she has been waiting 30, 35 years to tell that story. So a lifetime of whatever it is, frustration or observation, or that all comes out. I feel the same way about cinema. I think that mankind had been looking for this magnificently verisimilar art form which really mirrors life, and that the first 30 years of it, it all came out. And before it was harnessed to be really industrial and present a more reliable, predictable, marketable product, silent film from the get-go is just all over the place and often much more oneric, more dreamlike in its imagery, and taps into how cinema's relationship with dream and the excitement of creating cinema, creating a new art form.
Margot Martindale said you directed the scene that we were discussing earlier on the park bench as if it were a silent film. What does that mean?
I don't know exactly what she meant, but probably, and I direct a lot like this, which is talking through takes. So
what does that mean?
The actor is acting, and I'm coaching them through the performance moment by moment like they used to do, you know, in that cliche with the director with the jodhpurs and the megaphone. So I'm saying, oh, do this now, look left, look right, look up, feel sad, cry. I might say if they don't get a line quite right, I might tell the camera, okay, keep rolling. Now try that line again, but do it this way. Stick to your guns a little bit more, or whatever it is. I talk through takes a lot.
Alexander Payne, it's just been great to talk with you.
Thank
you so much.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
Alexander Payne speaking with Terry Gross. Payne's film Nebraska's been nominated for 6 Academy Awards. It's out on DVD next week. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Sit for Life and Herman Miller, featuring the Aeron Chair, including the True Black Color. Sit for Less is now sitforlife.com. From Netflix, presenting Season 2 of House of Cards, starring Kevin Spacey, Robin Wright, and Kate Mara. All episodes now available on Netflix. And from eSurance, with an app that lets users manage their car insurance policies, update payment info, and handle claims at eSurance.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, Matthew McConaughey tells us about making the transition into more serious roles after being typecast in romantic comedies. He'll also tell us about having one of the worst cases of acne ever. There's a story there. And David Edelstein reviews The Wind Rises, the new film by acclaimed Japanese animator Hayao Miyazaki. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. In the film Dallas Buyers Club, Matthew McConaughey plays a homophobic man who's diagnosed as HIV positive and given 30 days to live. He begins smuggling non-approved pharmaceuticals into the country from abroad after learning about the ineffectiveness and side effects of the drugs being prescribed in the U.S. He not only treats himself with the drugs, but also distributes them to other patients through a buyer's club, a way to skirt the FDA rules which prohibited the use of those medications.
This is my patient. You treating these people?
Oh, they're treating themselves.
With what?
Vitamins, peptide T, DDC, anything but that poison you're hawking.
McConaughey's performance in Dallas Buyers Club has earned him an Oscar nomination for Best Actor. He also makes a notable appearance in the opening scene of Martin Scorsese's The Wolf of Wall Street and is now starring in the HBO series True Detective, which is set in a remote area of Louisiana. McConaughey plays Detective Rust Cole. He's prone to dark and enigmatic monologues, sometimes to the annoyance of his more straightforward partner, played by Woody Harrelson.
I think human consciousness was a tragic misstep in evolution. We became too self-aware. Nature created an aspect of nature separate from itself. We are creatures that should not exist by natural law.
That sounds awful, Rush.
We are things that labor under the illusion of having a self, this accretion of sensory experience and feeling, programmed with total assurance that we are each somebody, when in fact everybody's nobody.
I wouldn't go around spouting that shit. I was you. People around here don't think that way. I don't think that way.
I think the honorable thing for our species to do is deny our programming. Stop reproducing. Walk hand in hand into extinction. One last midnight, brothers and sisters opting out of a raw deal.
So, what's the point of getting out of bed in the morning?
I tell myself I bear witness. The real answer is that it's obviously my programming. And I lack the constitution for suicide.
My luck, I picked today to get to know you. 3 months, I don't hear a word from you. And
you asked.
Yeah, and now I'm begging you to shut the f*** up.
Earlier in his career, McConaughey starred in lighter films, including romantic comedies like The Wedding Planner and Failure to Launch. But for the past several years, he's gravitated towards more dramatic and darker roles. He played a sinister and perverted police detective and hitman in Killer Joe, the owner and MC of a male review in a strip club in the film Magic Mike, and a mysterious loner in the film Mud. Terry interviewed McConaughey last year. Here's an excerpt of their conversation.
You had been famous for romantic comedies for several years, and now you're using your good looks for different effect. In Mud, your good looks help further the charisma that you have and the kind of romantic story that's at the heart of who you are and what motivates you. In Killer Joe, your good looks kind of add to this character's magnetism and charisma, even though it's a kind of evil charisma. And in Bernie, which is a comedy, your good looks are kind of played down, but you're the kind of like heartthrob in the local town. But it's all very comic. So was there a point in your career where you said, "I'm kind of done with the straightforward romantic comedies, I'm looking for something different now"? And if so, what was behind the change?
I've been asked this question a lot, and I've thought about it a lot. And I don't have a clear, clean-cut answer, because actually these roles, these last six films I've done, they came to me. I didn't go out and chase them. There was a time where I was reading some more romantic comedies. I was reading some more action scripts, and there were quite a few I liked. But most all of them, I felt like I could do them tomorrow. And I think that was where I just said, wait a minute, there's nothing wrong with that. That's great to have something you feel like you could do tomorrow. It's great to have your so-called fastball, and you like doing them. There's a lightness that you are able to keep and maintain in those that they need, because they need a buoyancy. And I call them a Saturday character, a romantic comedy. It's a Saturday character. You're not supposed to get Hamleshian about it. You're not supposed to go deep. You go deep on those, you sink the ship. I have fun doing that, and also trying to do those without emasculating the male, which can be done in those romantic comedies often. But I just felt like I could do them tomorrow or the next day. So I said, I want to wait. I don't know what I want to do. I want to wait till something really turns me on, moves my floor, as I said, makes me question it and go, I don't know what I'll do with that material. And what I had in my life at that time was something really special, which allowed me to take pause and back away and not do the romantic comedies or not do the other scripts that were coming in. And that's what, and I had a son. So I said, I'm going to be a dad. I've got something to take up my time. That helped a lot to have, to say I'm going to be a father for a while and I'm not going to rush into work. Let the work come find me and just be patient, McConaughey, it'll come. And so if I didn't have that project, which was raising my son or getting to know him in his earliest years, I would have become much more restless than I was. Mm-hmm. So I was able to be very patient. And what happened is I got the call from Billy Friedkin. Then Richard Linklater came to me with the Bernie script. Then I got the call from Soderbergh. Then Lee Daniels gave me a call on Paperboy. So they came to me, and that was just really one of those wonderful ways the world works, by saying, no, I don't want to do these other things. I'm going to sit and press pause and let some things come to me and sort of, as I said, let the target draw the arrow. The arrows came my way.
Matthew McConaughey speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and we're listening to Terry's interview with actor Matthew McConaughey. He's earned an Oscar nomination for Best Actor for his performance in the film Dallas Buyers Club.
In high school, you were voted most handsome in the school. So did you have to be knocked down at home after that?
Oh, I think they still, I mean, my brother still jives me about it. I have a wonderful story, though, about that most handsome thing.
Shoot, go ahead. Yep.
Oil of mink was a product. My mother became an in-house salesman for. It was a mink oil that you put on your face. And my mom was turned on to it by my father's secretary. And it was one of these kind of like the Avon ladies. You go door to door and you sell this oil of mink. Well, I'm 15 years old. And my mom's got these tubes of mink oil. And she says, you know, you've got these adolescent pimples and stuff. Maybe you should put the oil of mink on your face and do these masks and stuff at night. And I'm like, that's a great idea, Mom. And we read the label, and one of them says that it pulls out the impurities. And then you'll be clean. You'll never have another blemish in your life. And I'm like, well, this is great, man. If I can get through these, you know, 15-year-old pimply face stuff, it'd be great. So I start putting these oil of mink masks on my face. Well, quickly, my face is beginning to swell up. I'm forming acne, and a really bad acne. And I talked to my dad's secretary, who turned my mom onto it. She comes over to the house, and I'm really concerned. And the lady's like, wow, well, you just sure have a whole lot of impurities, Matthew. Keep it up. And we'll just pull all the impurities out, because once they're out, you're clean forever. So I stick with it another 3 weeks. It's almost 2 months now, and my whole face, I don't even look like myself. I have full-blown, really bad acne. Go to a dermatologist. He's like, what are you putting on your face? We show him the product. He's like, this is a mink oil base. This is the last thing an adolescent oily-faced kid should be using. This has clogged up your pores. You are about 10 days before you're going to have those ice picks holes in your face from that acne. And we're like, well, geez, how do we help? He got me on medication. It ended up being Accutane, which really worked. It was a year and a half, sort of just took the acne away, and we learned our lesson. Anyway, during that time, somebody in the family got the idea of, yeah, you know what? We need to file a lawsuit against Oil of Mink. That's right. Our son, Matthew, I mean, you've been, look at you. I mean, you were emotionally pounded and psychologically this really had to hurt. And so everyone started feeling all these, you know, ideas. But yeah, I was emotionally done. Yeah, my confidence was lowered. Well, there's a lawsuit filed. I think it's for like $30,000 or something. And as lawsuits go, they take a while. So remember, that was when I was 15. Cut to now I'm 18, senior in high school. I get called in for a deposition by the the defense. And he sits me down and he goes through all this, you know, and emotionally this must have been so tough for you. And look at these pictures, this acne you had. Oh, my God. I mean, your face is almost bleeding. You look like a monster. This is so bad. Man, it must have really been tough on you. And I'm like, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And he goes through this for about 45 minutes. And I'm thinking, this is great, man. This is the defense talking to me. And he's saying all the problems that I had. And then he stops and he reaches down under the table and he pulls up this yearbook. And he opens up this page, turns around to me and slides over. And he goes, what's this picture here, this award you won? I look down at it and it says, most handsome. And he goes, yeah. It was just really tough, that Olaminka episode, wasn't it? And I shut that book, started laughing. My dad jacked with me and my brothers jacked with me for years after that, going, man, we almost won a $30,000 lawsuit and you got to go win most handsome, you son of a bitch. Man, what are you doing? Trying to make some money in a lawsuit. And what's little brother do? Got to go win most handsome. Thanks a lot, man. You just screwed it up for all of us. So I still get hell about that.
So was being on the stand useful in playing a lawyer, which you've done?
Well, actually, that was in a law office. But I was very interested in law back then. And I thought my path was going to be, I was going to be the family lawyer. I was going to SMU is where I was going to go to school.
Why didn't you become the family lawyer?
I was going to go to SMU. I was going to, because I felt I could get a job in a law firm easier in Dallas than anywhere else that I was going to go to school. And I got a call from my middle brother, and he said, you know, what about University of Texas? And I said, no, I don't want to, you know, I want to go to SMU because it's Dallas, and I think that's where I can get into the workforce sooner and in a law office. And he goes, well, look, Dad's not going to tell you this, but I'm going to tell you this. It's going to cost $16,000 to put you in SMU because it's a private school. But if you go to University of Texas, it's going to cost $6,000. And Dad's not going to tell you, but the oil business is not good right now. And Dad's business is really tough. It would help him out a lot. Because, of course, my dad wouldn't say, you know, I can't afford to send you to SMU. So I called Dad and I said, you know what? I had a change of mind. I want to be a Longhorn. And he goes, God, dog, buddy, I like the sound of that. And I went to University of Texas, and as soon as I got to Austin, I fit into it, and it fit with me. The first 2 years, I was still thinking about going to law school, but it's a time where I got really creative and decided, you know what, that's not for me. And that's when I decided to get in the storytelling business, and I didn't think it was going to be acting. I went to film school.
So how did you become an actor then?
In film school, I started when I would be directing something or the photographer or even the AD, I would always find myself jumping on the other side of the camera and acting it out what I meant if I was trying to give direction or saying, well, let me do that. And then when I went to Hollywood, I had a production assistant job that I went out there for. And I was interested in acting, but I still wasn't able to shake hands even with myself that was really going to be a possible career. And somebody liked what I did in Dazed Confused. An agent said, I want to meet you, and sent me out on a read. And the first read I ever had in Hollywood, 2 weeks after I'd been out there, was with a casting director named Hank McCann, and it was for a film called Boys on the Side, which I ended up getting the part and never had to take that production assistant job.
So Dazed and Confused seemed like an aberration to you because did you know the director, Richard Linklater? Were you friends or
no,
something?
No, I didn't. I met the casting director, Don Phillips, on that film in a bar one night, top of the Hyatt, Thursday night, with my girlfriend at the time, Tony Sedaris. We went to that bar because I knew the bartender, and he'd give me free drinks. And he said, he was in film school with me. He goes, guy at the end of the bar is a producer. He's in town producing a film. I went down to introduce myself. 4 hours later, we're kicked out of the bar. And he says, you ever acted before? I said, man, I was in a Miller Lite commercial for about that long. And he goes, well, you might be right for this role. Come to this address tomorrow morning, 9:00, and at this time it was already 3 a.m. And I went down there 6 hours later, and there was a script with a handwritten note on top of it, and it had this character's name was Wooderson. There was had a few great, great lines.
Some of them are famous. You want to recite the famous ones?
Oh, well, the one that was like that sent me off, and I was just like, who is this guy, is when they're out front of the the billiards joint, and the ladies are walking by, and Wooderson's checking them out, and he's there with the character played by Sasha Jensen. And Sasha's like, you better stop that, man. You're going to end up in jail. And Wooderson's like, no, man. That's what I like about those high school girls, man. I get older, but they stay the same age. And it was the piece for Wooderson that I was like, that's not a line. That's his being. That's his philosophy. He wasn't – there was no attitude to it. This was this guy's DNA, and he had it figured out.
So let's play the actual scene, which we have ready to go. This is Dazed and Confused, which is set in 1976 on the last day of high school. Matthew McConaughey plays somebody who's already out of high school. He's kind of too old for this, but is still hanging with the high school kids.
So you're a freshman, right?
Yeah.
So tell me, man, how's this year's crop of freshman chicks look?
Well, you're gonna end up in jail sometime really soon. I know that. Fact.
No, man. Yeah. No, man, I'll tell you. Yeah. That's what I love about these high school girls, man. I get older, they stay the same age.
Yes, they do. God.
Yes, they do.
A much younger Matthew McConaughey in a scene from Dazed and Confused, which was directed by Richard Linklater. So I read that your parents were married and divorced and married and divorced. Was that confusing for you?
I didn't know. Again, those things you find out after after your father passes away. I thought Mom was on some extended vacations. You know, I thought she was down in Florida. And I didn't, you know, but I didn't question why Dad and I moved into a trailer park outside of town and it was just he and I for the whole summer. I didn't question it. Again, my older brothers probably went through and understood what was happening. It wasn't really confusing. I mean, there were never times where I remember like, oh, my God, where's Mom? I mean, the summer I had with my dad when Mom was gone, boy, that was neat. I'm going to spend it with Dad. You know, so it wasn't ever confusing. I mean, I never questioned, oh, our mom and dad split up. Does one love me more or love me less? We didn't have none of that.
What was high school like for you?
I had a very good time in high school. I took care of my business. I made my A's from Mom and Dad. I was socially active. I was mostly very extroverted. I had a good friend, though, who has a lot to do with why I'm doing what I'm doing today, named Rob Bendler. He was the introvert, so to speak. And he was the one who introduced me to, hey, you don't have to go party Friday and Saturday night. I'll go party with you Friday night, but Saturday night, let's go to my place and watch a movie. And so he introduced me to films. He introduced me to art. He introduced me to storytelling. And he was writing scripts. And he went to NYU. And he was the one who said, why don't you go try and act? He was the one, when I couldn't even dream about it, he was saying, no, I think you could do this and do it really well.
What's one of the films that you fell in love with that made you fall in love with movies?
Oh, I mean, you know, at that time, I think it was like Angel Heart, that Alan Parker film I loved with Mickey Rourke and De Niro and Lisa Bonet. I really loved that film. Hud was always a favorite of mine, the Marty Ritt-directed film with Paul Newman. Later on, Indian Runner, Sean Penn's film, wonderful film that Viggo Mortensen and David Morse were in. You know, Raising Arizona was my comedy, you know, the most quotable that I've watched over and over and over. And then again, the only movie I saw before I was like 15 was King Kong. And I must say,
which version, the remake or the original?
The remake, introducing Jessica Lange.
With Jeff Bridges.
Yes. And
it's a terrible
I
film, I think. Really? Okay, you cried.
Oh, I loved it. Really? I absolutely loved it. And I'm very interested in this measurement across the board. It's like I was whatever age I was, 12, 13, 14, and I've never had more enjoyment in a film-going experience than that hour and a half that I was in for that movie at that age. Hmm. I cried at because I knew Jessica Lange and King Kong could have made it. I knew that they could have made it. You know?
Matthew McConaughey speaking with Terry Gross. McConaughey's nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actor for his performance in the film Dallas Buyers Club, and he stars in the HBO drama True Detective. Coming up, David Edelstein on the new film by Japanese animator Hayao Miyazaki. This is Fresh Air. The new film from acclaimed Japanese animator Hayao Miyazaki is called The Wind Rises. It centers on a young man who in the early 1930s dreams of designing the perfect airplane. The film's been nominated for Best Animated Feature at this year's Academy Awards. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
The 73-year-old Japanese animation titan Hayao Miyazaki says The Wind Rises is his final film. And if that's true, and I hope it's not, but fear it is, since he's not the type to make rash declarations, if that's true, he's going out on a high. The movie won't, I'm afraid, appeal to kids the way Ponyo or Spirited Away does. It's monster, ghost, and mermaid free. It centers on grown-ups, and it's gently paced. Maybe 15 minutes too long, I'd say, but you can forgive those longueurs when the work is this exquisite. It's romantic, tragic, and inexorably strange. A portrait of a young Japanese man who dreams of creating flying machines and the Imperial Empire that funds his research. His country will take those machines and send them off to rain death and destruction on its enemies. But that's not something to which the young designer gives too much thought. It's not part of the dream of flight. The young man's name is Jiro, a composite of engineer Jiro Horikoshi and writer Tatsuo Hori, who wrote a novel called, also, The Wind Rises. From an early age, Jiro pores over drawings in English-language aeronautical magazines and communes in his fantasies with a visionary Italian aircraft designer called Caproni. There's only a whisper of distinction between Jiro's so-called reality and his dreams. In his visions, the young enthusiast, voiced in Disney's English-language version by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, stands on the wing of a plane under pink and gold cumulus clouds. Caproni, voiced by Stanley Tucci, is there too, and they gaze in awe on an approaching flying machine.
Which world will you choose?
I just want to create beautiful airplanes.
Like that? Very graceful.
I have a long way to go. I don't even have an engine or a cockpit yet.
Bravo! A beautiful dream.
The machine spoken of by Jiro and his Obi-Wan Caproni looks like a mechanically enhanced bird. There's barely any border between objects that are natural and engineered. Jiro's chief design is inspired by the curve of a mackerel bone. He takes his cues from living creatures. Miyazaki has given us living machines before, among them the mythical bus in My Neighbor Totoro. But here, they're a mix of inorganic and organic. Everything has a spirit, levers, flaps, and of course, the wind. The title comes from a line by poet Paul Valéry, "The wind is rising, we must try to live." It's the Buddhist carpe diem, go with the flow. The wind carries off the parasol of a fragile girl, Nahoko, voiced by Emily Blunt, and into the hands of Jiro, who'll fall in love with her. Their love is idealized, but what an ideal. Though she's obviously dying of TB, she's plucky. She faces into the wind. The movie's central contradiction is between the purity of Jiro's dreams and the deadly uses to which his plane, the legendary Zero Fighter, is put. Does Miyazaki downplay the evil? Some critics say yes. One even stopped an awards meeting of a Boston Critics Society to say that anyone who voted for the movie was accepting the whitewash of atrocities. I don't see it that way. Miyazaki's irony isn't as broad as, say, Bertolt Brecht's in Galileo, the tragedy of a man whose appetite for science and lack of regard for its consequences lead inevitably, in Brecht's formulation, to weapons of mass destruction. But it's hard to imagine Miyazaki being that on the nose. The terrible implications are there, but underplayed. It's the underplaying and the evenness of tone that's the key to his greatness, the way he transforms mundane sensations from real to surreal in barely perceptible puffs. And he puts so much individuality and soul into these anime characters with their standard button eyes and tiny noses that it's uncanny. He makes the human spirit seem as fleeting yet as eternal as the wind itself.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing reviews of local roofers, painters, landscapers, and plumbers to keep the consumer informed. More at angieslist.com. From Lumosity.com, dedicated to improving memory and attention with neuroscience-based games for the brain at Lumosity.com. And from Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, going off the grid to protect your privacy. Reporter Julia Angwin was tired of online advertisers peeking at her web searches and growing surveillance everywhere, so she decided to erase her digital footprint, encrypting email, buying disposable cell phones, even creating a fake identity. She tells the story in her book, Dragnet Nation. Join us.